www.ReachForTheStars.com.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you along with Bonnie Berman. Good afternoon, Bonnie.
Good afternoon.
Interesting program today.
It is indeed.
The 21st century marks a decided change in the balance between the sexes. There are more women than men in the workforce, and female managers outnumber males. Women outnumber men on college campuses as well. Joining us now is journalist and author Hannah Rosen. Her latest book is The End of Men and the Rise of Women. She joins us from Washington, D.C. Hello, Hannah.
Hi. I didn't mean to scare you.
So what made you pursue this new world order?
So I just noticed one time, I was thinking about the recession and what had happened to men, and I really just wanted to check in on that as a journalist. You know, we'd had a series of recessions. Susan Faludi wrote a wonderful book called Stiffed, which described the changes in American manhood, and I thought, where are they now? And so I followed this particular couple, and it was they had a baby together, but they weren't married, and he wasn't working, and I kept trying to get him to get his life back, you know, like, can this marriage be saved? And we were talking for months, and he was going to be one of my subjects until one day I realized I was asking all the wrong questions. He wasn't going to just jump back to his life because the landscape had completely changed, his domestic landscape, the landscape of the workforce around him. And his wife wasn't going to give up her position of dominance, or his girlfriend, rather. So it got me thinking about what was happening more broadly, you know, whether the relationships and the way that the world has been set up is no longer.
So tell us how it is now. Hi, Hannah. Bonnie here.
Hi, Bonnie.
When did this all begin? When would you say did it begin with the feminist movement? When did it actually begin?
That's an excellent question. The feminist movement is part of the story, but this isn't a straightforward feminist story because a lot of the women I write about would never call themselves feminists. They kind of found themselves in this breadwinner position, sometimes against their will. You know, sometimes it starts out against their will and then they're happy to find it that way. It just kind of isn't a reality for a lot of these families more than it is like marching in the streets kind of triumph the way it has been in the past. The feminist movement allowed women to rise and take advantage of certain positions and go to school in greater numbers. So it's, you know, the fact that it existed was helpful for a lot of these women. But mostly it became an economic reality. It started as one about 40 years ago when the manufacturing economy began to decline and it became more difficult to, you know, be a certain kind of man and live a certain kind of way and still have a successful middle class life. And then over those 40 or 50 years, my great surprise was seeing how deeply it had seeped into our intimate relationships, how, you know, who we choose as marriage partners, what decisions we make about sex, you know, how marriage looks in the rest of America. So it became this real domestic how we live now kind of reality, which is what I describe in the book.
Are men on the decline because there are fewer jobs requiring strength and brawn? There's not as much manufacturing and heavy lifting to do?
That's where it starts. It starts like that, where the manufacturing economy sort of fades away and gets replaced by effectively a service economy and a creative economy. And then you have certain skill. Then you have an economy which plays to the natural strengths of women, to sit still and focus, to get their degrees, to cooperate, you know, to be more collaborative in their leadership decision making. Again, these are stereotypes, but, you know, women have been socialized to be this way, so it's easier for them to do. And then it just expands from there.
And would you say that this is worldwide? I mean, it's in the United States. Where else is it really prominent?
It expresses itself in a totally different way in different countries. So it is to some extent happening worldwide. But of course, you know, there's a lot more barriers for a woman to get ahead in, say, Saudi Arabia than there is in America. And in America, it looks very different than it looks in Korea. One of my chapters is about Korea and Asia more broadly. And you see there that women are rising so quickly, but the society is extremely resistant. It's a very patriarchal society. So, you know, you get fits and starts and lots more tensions, and they show up in different ways. And the same is true for all countries. I mean, one amazing trend that one of the demographers, he's a Spanish demographer, talked to me about that is happening worldwide is the trend of women marrying down, which has never happened before. Traditionally, women who are in their early 20s and 30s of marrying age. They look to marry someone who has better prospects than they do. But there aren't as many men with better prospects than women have at that age. So all around the world, in European countries and Latin American countries, you see women doing what demographers called marrying down.
Tell us, Hannah, in the book, I was really struck by this business in Japan with the herbivores and carnivores. It was really surprising. Tell us about it.
That's one of my favorite stories. You know, often when you read trend stories in Japan, it's just you can't really make sense of them. And it's only because I understand the trends of men and women. There seems to be a kind of gender face down, let's say. Can we call it that? Where the women are having a lot of economic independence, take in Japan and Korea. They are very test-based societies, and women do well in test-based societies. So they're winning top positions in schools and universities and sort of alarming the authorities. But as I said, you know, the culture is pretty patriarchal. So what we expect of a wife hasn't changed very much at all in Asian society. And so these wives, you know, have a lot of buying power. They're doing well at work. And suddenly they're supposed to marry someone who expects them to be a kind of old style, traditional domestic wife. And so the men look at these women as aliens and the women look at the men as their enemies. And so effectively what happens is they delay marriage for as long as possible. So the age of first marriage in Korea, for example, is 32, which is incredibly high and has raised so much in the last few years. And, you know, what you get is these funny cultural protests. And one of them that's been written about is about the Japanese herbivores, as you describe them. And they're men who are basically protesting traditional forms of manhood and manly responsibility and behaving in ways that we would consider very feminine. And so, you know, they organize explicitly so. So they organize gardening parties and dessert parties. You know, rather than be the sort of salary man that their father was, they're acting almost cartoonishly feminine. And instead of having relationships with women, one often reads about, you know, they go on honeymoons with their virtual girlfriends, for example, because the real women are, I guess, too frightening and alien. And so there's just kind of a disconnect between the sexes.
What are their virtual girlfriends?
You know, this is the next story I want to write. I wish I had had time to explore it. It's on my list. You know, go find out about those virtual girlfriends. They're girlfriends that exist online. Like, they have personalities. You create them. It's not as porn as it sounds. You know, it's not really just about that. It's just more like, you know, a girlfriend with certain personality traits that exists online but is not necessarily a real person, but who you develop an attachment with, like an avatar girlfriend. And so one hears reports of there are traditional honeymoon locations where you used to go with your, you know, bride, and now groups of men go with their virtual girlfriends. I can't speak to how popular this is, but these are trend stories you read about Japan.
I read one of your facts that really surprised me. It was a study that was done that the greater the power of women in a country, the greater the country's economic success.
That's generally true. I think a lot of the international organizations really push that research because they're trying to get certain countries, say Afghanistan, to equalize and really pay attention to women's education. So what's happening nowadays is having women be successful is identified with the country's overall success and its economic success. So whereas oppressing women is seen to be something that will hold the entire country back. And I think that thinking is taking hold worldwide. So people recognize if you keep women back, you know, you seem anachronistic and you will not rise in the world economy. And so if you want to be one of the successful countries, you have to let your women loose.
So why are things more difficult for men in this era?
I have puzzled over this question. I do not like to end at the notion that, you know, men are innately one way and women are innately the other way. I don't think we have nearly enough neurological, biological evidence to conclude that. It has something to do with the interaction between biology and culture. And I think men are that way because it's been fine to be that way. You know, it turns out there's some advantage to being the underdog, which we're seeing now. So men are a little more narrow, I think, or maybe inflexible. And really, people get so annoyed when I say things like this. Obviously, this is not true of every single man in every single way, but I'm speaking in broad historical terms. If you look at the different public roles that women have been able to occupy over the century. So, you know, it used to be that women couldn't work at all. And then they couldn't work when they got married. And then they couldn't work when they had a kid. You know, women have sort of broken down every one of these barriers, and they've had a character on television, you know, to validate it and make it mainstream. So Mary Tyler Moore or a Murphy Brown. And, you know, so it sort of becomes a part of the culture really quickly. And they've had a women's movement. Whereas for men, the equivalent just hasn't happened. You know, women have not moved into spheres that they haven't done before. They don't rapidly move into what we consider traditionally feminine tasks or traditionally feminist professions. In fact, quite the opposite. You know, if women start to flood a profession, say the medical field or, you know, secretarial field or teachers, men immediately flee, you know, whereas it's seen kind of still as unmanly to do a job that we think of as a womanly job.
Although your study on Calvin was very, very interesting, that he ended up becoming a nurse, if you want to tell that story.
I do want to tell that story. The person who I started in my introduction, the one who got me thinking about all of this in the first place, really seemed stuck. You know, and once I concluded that I was on the wrong path and that it was his girlfriend was actually going to be dominant forever, you know, I wasn't sure what was going to happen to Calvin. And then I checked in with him sort of many months later as I was closing off the book and thinking about my conclusion. And he told me this very heartbreaking story where he'd been in this series of car accidents and he'd really had a kind of eye-opening life experience. And his wife had been so successful in nursing school that he thought he would try it too. And he's a very gentle man, you know, maybe not all that reliable, but very gentle. So I can see, you know, how, and he'd also started to get into contact with his daughter. I can see how it would work for him. And he turned in his application and he said, you know, he was never more nervous than when he put in the papers, meaning the application papers to the school, to see whether he could do it. It's really a heartwarming story. I will only put one caveat on it. I don't want men to think that I'm saying you all need to be completely feminized. There was a sitcom made largely based on the end of men argument in which the men literally had to dress up like women in order to get a job. Like, they took my thesis so literally. The sitcom never aired, but the pilot got made. And so, you know, you had these guys. It was like, you know, Victor Victoria. They were like, you know, put on their fake business and their dresses and shaved their legs and sort of went to get a job and got this wonderful job. And so I don't mean it that literally. You don't all have to become women. But we do have to think about, for example, what to do about men, a dignified exit for men who were a very big part of the manufacturing economy.
We're speaking with Hanna Rosin. Her latest book is The End of Men and the Rise of Women. She's a journalist and an author. Hanna, we have to take a short break. We'll be right back.
And you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station. We're funded by listeners like you and by South Florida Dental Implant Group. Dental implants can alleviate the discomfort of dentures, the loss of taste, and difficulty chewing. The South Florida Dental Implant Group dedicated to giving you the freedom to chew. Details at 1-800-541-3010. City Year Miami unites a diverse group of 17 to 24-year-olds for a year of service as tutors, mentors, and role models who make a difference to students and schools. You can learn more online at cityyear.org. City Year, give a year, change the world.
Like Topical Currents' Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And 20 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and my colleague Bonnie Berman with you on this Tuesday afternoon. We're speaking with Hanna Rosin about her book, The End of Men and the Rise of Women. Hanna, where can our listeners go to online to find out more about you and the book?
You can go to my website, which is www.hannarosin.com, and you can always order the book, The End of Men, on Amazon, of course. And my own website gives you several links, if you're not an Amazon person, to independent bookstores and various other places.
Now, you're also the founder of Slate's Double X. What does that mean?
That's part of the story. I was running a women's site at the time, and so all the trends were coming at me very quickly, and it was hard to put them together. You know, you had statistics about how women were doing in college, and suddenly, you know, women getting more PhDs, and suddenly you get a headline that's like, more female breadwinners than ever. And, you know, it sort of takes a while before you put all the pieces together and realize that something profound is happening in our culture.
Is it that in the 21st century, the job requirements have changed so much and women are better, they have better social and communication skills?
That is part of the story. Part of it is social and communication skills, as you say, the ability to make it through school, frankly. A college degree is a prerequisite to success, whether we like it or not these days, and women are just better at getting college degrees. They're not smarter. No one's saying women are smarter. They're really not. They test about equally, men and women. It's these external skills that they seem to have.
And perhaps they're less likely to party away their college career.
Yeah, I mean, people talk. There's something that people are trying to define called the social intensity syndrome. I'm not sure if I'm quite there, but it's the idea that men get so drawn into video games and, you know, pornography that they don't that they actually forget the skill of communicating with a live woman. That's what they, you know, that's something that people are trying to define. Now, I don't know about whether it's a syndrome yet, but I will say there are a lot more distractions that tend to draw men in. If you talk to college girls, you will always hear that about the men playing video games while the women are in the hall studying. Now, that too reinforces stereotypes about, you know, the goody two-shoes girls and the, you know, rowdy boys. But to some extent, I think the stuff which may have been always true but didn't matter as much, now the difference is that it matters. I mean, probably girls were always better at school and always better at sitting still. But, you know, in 1910, there were more high school female graduates than men, but it didn't matter as much because there weren't as many places for women to go.
Right. So if there are more women that are managers now, why is there still the pay disparity?
So it's managers and professionals,
I will say.
Yeah, sure. They're slightly different because, you know, whatever, manager is a certain title. But those are two separate issues. So the wage gap, which often comes up, has to do with, you know, Bob has a job and Jane has a job at the same job, and Bob gets paid a little bit more than Jane for the same amount of work. That still is true and has to do with – it's not – as true as people think it is, because often what happens is that women end up working less time over a career. They work part-time. And, you know, part of that, which I write about in my book, is because women are still worse at negotiating their starting salaries. That's something that's been well documented, women's reluctance to negotiate, which is something that we need to get over. But it's also true that at the very top, you have more men than women. Among the uber-rich, for example, that's almost entirely male. So, you know, the world doesn't flip upside down overnight. This is only been going on 40 or 50 years. Women are close to a tipping point where we become more comfortable and more familiar with women in positions of high power, but we're really still not there yet. We're in this transition moment. And that's one place in the book where I actually get pretty specific and self-helpy rather than anthropological, where I really try and explain to people, look, this is the moment we live in now. Women, here's how you have to present yourselves and what you have to say if you want to end run some of these stereotypes that are still out there.
Yeah, and as you point out, there's still very few women CEOs in major corporations.
Exactly. And I think that has to do with a few things. Partly our discomfort around women in power, as I just said, and partly it has to do with our workplace structure. One of the reasons that I wrote this book is I think we have still failed to acknowledge that women are so important in the American workforce and the economy. And we still operate a workplace as if there's one person at home full time. I mean, we all know this, but we are the only industrialized country that doesn't have maternity leave. That's totally bizarre for a country in which women are half of the workforce. It really doesn't make sense anymore. So I want people to kind of grasp this reality rather than resisting it and respond accordingly.
We're speaking with journalist and author Hannah Rosen about her book, The End of Men and the Rise of Women. If you'd like to join in the discussion, you're certainly welcome. That number is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN or email. That's radio at WLRN.org, radio at WLRN.org. Hannah, break it down as far as this gender gap that's growing versus income.
So, I'm sorry, can you ask me the question again?
Do higher income individuals tend to have less gender gap than lower income?
Less gender gap in what sense? You mean in pay?
Yeah, well, or be more likely to have a female dominance.
The higher income gap, no, right. Actually. That's not actually the way it falls down, because at the very highest level, you have a higher income gap between men and women, because women who marry very rich men tend not to work. That's for very rich men. But then as you go towards the bottom, actually...
That's what
I was
implying.
Oh, sorry. Okay, right. Sorry. Yes, that's right then. Sorry about that. And then at the very lower ends, actually, you have a bigger income gap. And I think that's because men are a harder hit in the middle and the bottom. And so women there are forced to basically hustle and keep their families together. It's what one MIT economist described to me as the last one holding the bag theory, which means that the women are left with the kids, so they have to hustle, you know, go to community college, try and sort of work their way up, have a job, raise the kids. And so there the disparities tend to be bigger.
So the woman's role in a working class family, which would be a more of a matriarchal structure right now, how does that compare with higher income homes in terms of the women's role?
I address this in my couple of chapters about marriage, and I explicitly wrote about two different kinds of marriages, because I think they work in exactly opposite ways right now. Marriage, like many other things in America, has become almost a class luxury. So for the college educated, we have what I call seesaw marriages, which means that the breadwinner role can go to any person at any time. You know, the Obama marriage is a perfect example. In the beginning of their marriage, Michelle Obama worked really hard in an executive position and supported Barack Obama, you know, who was going through law school, and now they've switched positions. And so that's pretty typical in America, and I think has also made for the happiest, most stable marriages are ironically in the kind of progressive, more democratic leaning areas. Largely, I think, because nobody feels trapped in one role or another the way they have in other times in history. Whereas in the non-college educated portion of America, marriage is going through a rapid decline. Divorce rates are as high as they were in the height of divorce rates in the 70s, and far fewer people are getting married. I think largely because there, again, is a little bit of a mismatch between the men and women. You know, maybe women have ambitions for themselves all of a sudden, and they're finding the men sort of wanting, you know.
Hannah Rosen, in this new world order, how has the college dating scene shifted?
We often talk about the hookup culture. Perhaps this is my most controversial chapter. I don't know. But we talk about the hookup chapter as if women are the victims of it always. And I have a slightly different take on it based on some wonderful research I came across, which is that women need the hookup culture and in some sense are perpetuating the hookup culture, largely because it's necessary to their academic careers. So while they may complain about it, you know, the day-to-day of it, I think, is unpleasant for many women. And it's not ultimately what they want. It's also necessary for them not to get entangled in long-term relationships that might derail certain decisions that they want to make. So I think that's the push and pull happening in the hookup culture right now.
And why are women more flexible than men?
That is the $100,000 question. Maybe that's not enough money. The $100 million. What's kind of counted as a lot of money in our society these days? I don't believe that it's because we're hardwired to be more flexible. I think it's because we've had to be more flexible. That women work and raise kids and have been the underdogs. I think it's also because women don't have any set expectations, like the women in Alabama who I write about how much they need to earn or what being the breadwinner is. You know, for them, this is all coming as a kind of new happy surprise. So they get to move forward, take on new tasks, do new jobs. It's like, you know, it's like sowing your oats. It's exciting. Whereas for men, it'll, you know, they have to grit their teeth like they had been one way and it had been very successful. And now it's hard for them to start at the bottom again.
So there's sort of a macho pride, and maybe they result in sort of a hangdog syndrome.
Yeah, but I don't want to, you know, I don't want to sort of deride it. I think it's completely real and understandable. You know, it's understandable that you'd been making, you know, $80,000 in your job as a manager or running your own private business, and suddenly, you know, you've got to start in the middle or the bottom. That's painful for anybody. And so I think it's just harder for them to adjust. But I make it pretty clear by the end of the book that it's not that I think that they can't adjust. I think they can, and I think that they will. We are in this profound transition moment. It's like, you know, sort of a hurricane coming in the country, and I'm not sure where all the pieces are going to land when it leaves, but I do feel like it's going to be different and potentially better.
Better. Well, that's,
potentially.
I hope so. When you talked about the plastic woman and the cardboard man, you explained it as this new comic duo, but you use it quite a bit to explain this flexibility that women have.
It's more an image that popped into my head when I was thinking about how to piece together the different sorts of trends I was seeing in every one of the separate chapters. So, you know, why were women behaving in ways that were more violent? You know, it seemed like they were sort of moving into kind of manly ways of behavior. And, you know, sexually, why were women sort of trying out these new things? And in terms of the workforce, why were women able to move into jobs that were previously considered men's jobs? And so this image popped in my mind of women who are, you know, elastic, flexible, more plastic, whereas men seemed a little more, you know, narrow. Like, they still don't seem to move into more domestic roles. Like, there's, considering how many women are in the workforce, you know, men have not picked up the slack to make up for the number of hours women are working in the workforce. So they're slower to change the idea of what it means to be a man and what's acceptable around manhood, whereas women are pretty quick to change what it means to be a woman in the public sphere.
They're just more flexible.
They're just more flexible, I guess.
I just want to talk about more about that violence that you just mentioned, but we need to take another break, Hanna Rosin. Her latest book is The End of Men and the Rise of Women, and we'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
And this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. That's South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM NPR for the Florida Keys. Did you know that Medicare's annual election period now starts on October 15th? Well, soon it will be time to make important decisions about your coverage. The state's SHINE program can guide you through the enrollment period. Why not call SHINE today at 1-800-963-5337?
We're funded by listeners like you and by Bal Harbour Shops. Pleased to announce new store openings of Alexander McQueen, Canali, Montclair, Stella McCartney, IWC, and Brigade. A complete store directory listing of fashion events and a new mobile app available at balharbourshops.com. What's America's number one cash crop? It isn't corn or wheat. It's cannabis. Hello, it's Bonnie Berman. Join us for Wednesday's Topical Currents when we visit with journalist Doug Fine, who explores the positives of decriminalizing marijuana. The federal war on drugs has placed cannabis in the same legal category as heroin. Fine has written Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution. That's Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Topical Currents. Join us.
And it is Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman with you today. We resume our conversation with journalist and author Hanna Rosin about her book, The End of Men and the Rise of Women. If you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio at WLRN.org. First caller, this is Don in Miami. Thanks for your patience, Don. Hi.
Hi, Joe. I think that Ms. Rosin may be overlooking the enormous influence of the chemical testosterone as a force of nature in physical and intellectual power. The physical dominance is obvious. By intellectual dominance, I mean power or force, not intellectual nuances such as in science or scholarship. For example, there are a few families that dominate international banking with enormous control over money, economics, and governments. Although we don't obviously see their names or any publishing of their balance sheets. That is something that's not likely to change in the next few generations.
What about that?
Going on a long time.
What about that, Hanna Rosin?
I actually think we are starting to see a change in how we think of testosterone. I mean, there's always these hormone studies like, about, for example, when the Wall Street crash happened, we began to actually reevaluate what we think of testosterone and see whether it was causing men to make reckless decisions. So there were all these studies that had catchy headlines like, is testosterone the new estrogen, you know? And I don't know that any of these things are true. What's interesting to me is the culture of science, the cultural shifts, the way we all start to now view testosterone with suspicion and the way that we used to view estrogen with suspicion, you know, these feminine hormones that cause women to make, you know, bad decisions and do crazy things. Now we're starting to think about that around testosterone.
I have an emailer here. He asked, is today's so-called war on women in any sense a backlash to the rise of women?
Absolutely. That was my first thought, especially when the war on women involved birth control, which seems so anachronistic and really doesn't make any sense when you think of how utterly dependent American families are on the ambition of women. The idea that people in this country would support a world in which birth control were more difficult to get. It's not just, you know, it's not, I'm not talking about whether it's culturally offensive. That's really up to every person to decide. It's an economic impossibility. You know, the majority of American families would fall apart if women were not able to take advantage of birth control. It's a crazy idea. So that's the first thing I thought, you know, these things are scary. You know, they're scary because they're happening inside your own home. It's not even like racial differences. Like, you know, everybody has a mother, you know, many people have wives and girlfriends and sisters. So these things are happening under your own nose. And so it's hard not to really react to them sometimes.
And we'll move along to our callers. We have Miguel in Miami. Hi, Miguel.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment, and that is that patriarchal-like attitudes are more property of people and power relations rather than a property of gender. So, for example, in my experience, which may differ from that of other men, but in those areas of the sciences that are now dominated by women, I see women in positions of power forming negative opinions about their male colleagues because in their private lives they enjoy activities that are thought of as masculine or macho, and those are interpreted as a juvenile or irresponsible. So, for example, I did martial arts for a long time, and even while I was working in the sciences, I used to fight. And when my boss found out, she asked me if I was a bully. And went on to tell me that I was probably been a bully my whole life. And I see this in other colleagues where riding motorcycles isn't just something you enjoy doing, but rather it's some sort of macho activity that's just irresponsible and born out of being a male, essentially. So I think feminism can make a real contribution to equality in the workplace when it doesn't simply turn the tables on men.
Hannah Rosen?
That is such an excellent point, and I contribute to that. I mean, the sort of comical reading of my book would cause one to say, oh, you're a dude, you're obsolete, and you should, you know, throw away your motorcycle. So in this publicity tour around the book, one thing I really want to emphasize is that there is a place for manly virtues. There are things having to do with men and macho that we would like to preserve. I think you're asking for disaster if you say to men, you know, you just have to be like a girl. Like, you know, you just have to turn into one of these Japanese herbivores and make yourself comically feminine, that will just cause all men to A, feel bad about themselves, and B, be rageful and angry at all women, which is not really where we want to be. So I think there, for sure, you should do martial arts are awesome, and you should, you know, you should say that to your boss, and they have nothing to do with being a bully, and women are just as, you know, whoever said that to you is the bully. You know, it's these things run in all directions. You can't just say comically, this list of 25 things that men do are bad and obsolete.
So how has the definition of masculinity changed then? And how is a man now portrayed in mass media?
I think how is it changing is really what I would say, because I think it's changing slowly, so it hasn't really changed yet. I think men, like our previous caller, what's happening now is that they're kind of stuck between two poles. One pole tells them that all these manly things, you know, being the white man boss, like those things are kind of not, you know, socially acceptable or PC or something. And then at the other end, you know, you have to totally feminize and wear a skirt in order to get a job. That's not an acceptable place to go either. So you're in the middle there where you're not really sure which way to go. That's how a lot of the men that I interviewed for my book describe it. And so what what I'm seeing on television is the very first glimpses of a redefined manhood, which includes, you know, a little bit of each. And so for the history of sitcoms, for example, the image of the domesticated man or any man in a domestic setting has been of a bumbling idiot, basically. You know, he knocks the dishes off the table. You know, he's like Homer Simpson, right? He's like the ultimate example. And, you know, that goes on. I was shocked. I looked at sitcoms back in the 50s, and it's like he's always the same idiot, you know? That's such a strong trope. And only recently, there's a show called Up All Night, which was also credited to my End of Men story that inspired this book. And it features a stay-at-home father. And in the beginning, they made him that typical idiot. Like, he couldn't find anything at the grocery store. You know, he was watching the hockey game and playing video games while the baby was falling off the couch. But over time, they've kind of relaxed into the figure. And now he's really a figure of parental wisdom. And more importantly, he's still sort of sexy to his wife. You know, he hasn't lost his manhood merely because he's a competent father at home. So you're seeing the first glimpses of a changing stereotype.
In the book, you use the term alpha wives. Could you explain that?
Yes. An alpha wife is the sociological shorthand for a wife who makes more money than her husband, which is a growing category in America, or, you know, female breadwinners, and which experts predict will be half of American families will be headed by a female breadwinner. This is a very, very new phenomenon. I mean, in the 70s, this was a tiny percentage of families. It's either somewhere around 5%, a little more or a little less. And now we're in the sort of mid-40s of families that are headed by a female breadwinner. So you can see that's a huge, huge domestic and psychological shift, which, you know, creates all sorts of challenges that need to be worked out.
Do you think that women today have too many choices?
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that I like to counter is the idea that this book is about some kind of feminist triumph. It's really not. I'm really marking a point in history. It's not a feminist polemic. And one of the reasons is because, you know, some of the things that are happening have not led us to be more happy. I mean, the measurements of female happiness from the 70s until now show unequivocally that women rate themselves less happy than they were 40 years ago. And I think that's largely because of choice. Because as I write, you know, I this is maybe mean, but I call women a kind of a slowly expanding colonial empire, which means that they take on new realms, like in the workforce, but they don't give up old ones. So they sort of hold on to the domestic sphere as they're kind of taking on new spheres. And that's hard and exhausting. And also, when you have too many choices, you also have too many spheres to find yourself wanting and failing in. So women are stressed out these days.
With those sentiments, though, Hannah, perhaps the book is overtitled?
The End of Men. It's true. You know what it should be titled? The End of Macho, or The End of a Certain Kind of Man, or, you know, it's like The Queen is Dead, Long Live the Queen. It should be something like that. You know, The End of Man, The Rise of a New Man. But, you know, none of those titles are as catchy. The title comes from my original Atlantic story, which I wrote 2 years ago and was not written by me. I did not even see the title until it was on the newsstand. So,
oh, I was wondering about that because you mentioned in your dedication you apologized. I think that's to your son, Jacob.
Yes, the title
of the book.
Exactly. I don't want to distance the title because it has stuck to me over time. It's become part of the idiom and the lexicon. It is the name for this argument. And the book almost, it's sort of yellow with a pink. It looks like a road sign. You know, it's like you're planting this sign in the ground and then people can sort of debate and talk around it. That's the idea of this argument. But my son is mortified by it, for sure.
Yeah, he said it was mean.
He said it's mean and bullying since we've talked about bullies. And he writes, you know, I write the book up in our top floor of our house, and he writes signs on the door every day about, you know, what a bullying title it is. He's 9 years old, and he won't come to any of my book events or anything.
Hannah, do you find it interesting that all of the callers on our phone-in board are male?
That is interesting. I often worry that I'll just be in the sort of, I love when men call and give their perspective. And I've been on radio shows with men in a debate, and I find that much more poignant because it's odd to have, you know, just me, a woman, sort of proclaiming on the state of manhood.
We are speaking with author Hannah Rosen about her book, The End of Men and the Rise of Women. We're going to take a short break and be back with more.
We appreciate your listening to Topical Currents today on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station. We're funded by listeners like you and by Dale Carnegie, South Florida, committing to providing executive coaching and training solutions for busy professionals, focusing in the areas of sales, leadership, customer service, presentations, and communication skills. Details at southflorida.dalecarnegie.com. The disease of addiction doesn't discriminate based on age or status. Comprehensive addiction treatment and recovery offered for older adults and baby boomers at Hanley Center, 855-718-2233. Hanley Center, recovery for life.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents, Tuesday edition. We're speaking with author and journalist Hannah Rosen. Her latest book is The End of Men and the Rise of Women, and I'm Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. So along with this shift, Hannah, have today's women become more violent and more aggressive?
Yes, I included a chapter about violence because I did not want people to think that, you know, women were sort of happy and much nicer, and that's what I was talking about, that a world dominated by women would be beautiful. What I'm talking about is people moving along continuums, and I think we take it for granted that men are dominant because they're more physically aggressive, and so I wanted to scramble our ideas about that and help us think about it a little differently by showing that women, as they gain more power, are behaving in violent ways that we used to think of as exclusively reserved for men. That doesn't mean we're anywhere near, say, you know, women don't tend to murder strangers. They're not nearly as, you know, murderous as men, but they're certainly a lot more violent than they used to be.
In what ways?
So, for example, there's been a lot more juvenile arrest rates of women. They've been increasing at a much faster rate than the arrest rates for men. And people argue over that means women are inherently violent. But I don't think you can say anybody's inherently more violent. I think it's just that women express forms of violence that they used to suppress, partly because they're more acceptable. Because on TV, you see people punching each other and you see street brawls. And that's sort of become part of our, you know, background. And so in domestic violence situations, women are sometimes violent, you know. And so I think where they used to restrain themselves. And the initial case I write about in that chapter is a poisoning case, because poison cases used to be sort of, we used to associate them with the powerlessness of women. You know, a domestic woman who buys a bottle of bleach and does what she can to get rid of her oppressive husband. Whereas now you're getting a handful of poison cases that are from powerful biomedical executives who want to off their husbands who they think are not worthy of them. Now, I'm not saying there's a ton of these cases. I'm just putting them out there to show you that these dynamics have shifted.
And let's take another caller. We've got Noah.
Yes, very good show.
He's in Deerfield.
Listen, being that this is September 11th, I want to ask you a question about war. If you go to Europe today, like a country like Sweden, you see it being overrun by aggressive Muslims, and they see the Swedes as being feminized and passive and non-aggressive, and they're not scared of saying anything. They'll go into a country like Denmark, and they'll do whatever they want. How are we going to fight these type of hyper-masculine cultures when our culture has become so feminized?
Can you address that, Hannah Rosen?
Yes. So one place where we seem to hold on to manly virtues, if I can call them that, is man a sort of protector, and things like war, you know, the things like fighting. I think we can divide these two strains and say, you know, we viscerally need men for that, and people seem to want men for that, and that is a great place to express brawn and the distinct role of men. I'm not saying they should all go off to war and kill themselves. I'm just saying we don't have to let the idea of the national protector go merely because we're saying men should be more, you know, taking care of their children or working in professions that are available right now, such as nurses. Like, a man who's a nurse can also be a great fighter in war, is what I'm saying. I wish we could untangle these different things and let, you know, men be men in some spheres and not in every sphere.
In the book, you mentioned that the influx of so many suburban office parks favor the rise of women. Why is that?
because this is a longstanding argument since the 70s, where actually even since the turn of the century, when the rise of office work came, men suddenly became alienated because work used to mean work. Work used to mean you produce something. You use your hands and there's a product of your hands, and that's like a beautiful thing and very meaningful. But the idea of sitting in an office and typing all day seemed unmanly to people when it initially came around. And then you started to have the rise of office parks in the 70s and 80s, and they were put in suburban and exurban areas largely to take advantage of, you know, this untapped pool of female talent, is how the real estate developers described it. So women could get, you know, back and forth easily and take care of their children. And that's when the world of work, you see men really resisting the changes in the workforce. These are pretty old and deep trends. They predate the recession.
And we'll move along to another caller. This is Jim in Fort Lauderdale. Hey, Jim.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. I have a quick question. Thank you for the show. I'm semi-retired, and in the old days, all the bad drivers, the guys who would squeal out and do all the nasty, aggressive things, were all usually young men. I've noticed lately, in the past few years, and I've actually said so to my wife, I said, I have begun to notice that the person who honks at me, cuts me off, and acts very aggressively are more and more young women.
Any thoughts of that, Hannah?
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the aggression argument. I mean, they might have suppressed that because they thought it was unladylike at a certain moment in history, and now they don't necessarily think it's unladylike. You know, we could think of this as entitled or too aggressive, or they're picking up bad habits. You know, I'm just using it to show that there aren't really, you know, there may be some fixed points on that continuum, you know, but women are becoming more aggressive. Look at, for example, you know, who our hero heroines are of the last few years, like in The Hunger Games. I mean, think of how the roles are reversed in The Hunger Games. You have Katniss Everdeen, the star of The Hunger Games, is, you know, she's the protector for her family. She's the provider for her family. She's aggressive. She knows how to kill, and she's very unpleasant. Now, none of those things are things that would have been acceptable in a woman, you know, very short time ago. And if you think of PETA, you know, the boy who she's paired with in The Hunger Games, he understands how to smile, how to win over a crowd, how to collaborate, how to paper things over. So, you know, you can see that we're starting to work out these new roles in our popular culture.
Right, right. You mention in the book that the era of the firstborn son is over, and you talk about sperm banks and people requesting. I was really surprised to hear about that shift. Can you talk about that?
Yes, it's you know, the data in the U.S. is spotty, so you go where you can find the most exact data, which is in sperm banks where people are looking, you know, looking for certain fertility treatments. And there I was surprised to find that, you know, it's overwhelmingly people asking for girls. Now, a lot of times this is because they have boys already. I mean, there's lots of explanations, but still the number is so high that you think that, you know, maybe women are empowered and mothers are empowered to ask for girls because they really, really want a girl, and a family is incomplete without a girl. The place where it's really shocking is in Korea. Those statistics are in the book in my chapter about Korea, because that society is so patriarchal, and they have actually kept excellent data over the years, and the first son preference has completely disappeared and has now flipped into daughter preference. And so that was also amazing to see.
So is it true that because more and more women are going to college, particularly with our major colleges, that there's going to be affirmative action policies to admit more men?
There already are affirmative action policies to admit more men. It's something that we Americans don't talk about, although they talk about it in other countries. One of my revelations was in talking to admissions counselors. If you look at big state schools and, you know, really good state schools, their ratio of men to women is something like 60% female, 40% male. But then you jump to the private universities and it's suddenly 50-50. And that's because private universities can do whatever they want. They can admit whoever they want to. They're not subject to the same federal policies. And so what they do is effectively enact affirmative action for men. That's the secret among admissions officers, that if they have a woman and a man, you know, who are equally qualified, they'll admit the man because there's fewer qualified male applicants than female at that stage.
Is that happening everywhere?
that happens everywhere. And it's just something that is horrible to talk about for some reason. Like the admissions counselors, one admissions counselor once wrote it in an op-ed in the New York Times and, you know, was highly pounced upon. And then I interviewed a few admissions counselors and they said, for sure, it's the secret among us. That's how we equalize our classes. And they think, you know, they totally defend it. They're not like ashamed of it. It's just odd to talk about. They think there should be college campuses that are half men and half women because that makes for a more pleasant college atmosphere. So they'd like to keep it that way. But I think, you know, it's sort of in our psyche, it's really, really hard for us to wrap our minds around the idea that in the elite training grounds, you know, the training grounds for the future leaders of America have to have affirmative action for men. That's weird.
With the election on the horizon, will this gender shift affect politics and voting?
Yes, because you see the different parties basically putting up different visions of men and women and what men and women do. And Ann Romney tells us we should trust Mitt, you know. And that's an interesting thing that taps into our certain notion of maybe a nostalgia for what we want from men and how we want them to be the protectors. I mean, this is just on an image level. And then you see the Democrats and the Republicans fighting over the single woman vote in a certain way, which gets into a lot of issues of, you know, who women are, how they make decisions, why there are so many single mothers. So all these dynamics really play into different themes of the election. And then, of course, the war on women, which you mentioned before.
Right. So, Hannah, we're almost out of time, but I just want to ask you if you're hopeful that men can learn to adapt to the changes and become more flexible as time goes on now.
Absolutely. I mean, the big takeaway from my book is nothing is fixed, nothing is set in stone. Men will have to do it. I mean, this is just an unsustainable situation. Men not providing for their families, in some cases, you know, men not being satisfied. Of course, they will be flexible enough.
Well, we certainly want to thank you. It's been a very interesting hour. We've been speaking with journalist and author Hannah Rosin. Her latest book is The End of Men and the Rise of Women. And once again, Hannah, where can people learn more about you and the book?
They can learn about me at www.hannahrosin.com. There you can find links to buy the book and everything else you'll need to know.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
And that wraps up today's program. My apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary gives production assistance as well. Find author and book links, such as today's, on the Topical Currents Facebook page. We also have free audio archives and MP3 downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. Tomorrow's program looks at the benefits or the downside of decriminalizing marijuana with journalist Doug Fine, author of Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution. Now the calendar. Of course, the 11th anniversary of terrorist 9/11 infamy. 2,752 death certificates were filed as a result of the attacks. Also on this day in 1885, 117 years ago, the birth of English writer D.H. Lawrence in Eastwood. Lady Chatterley's Lover. Women in Love. Sons and Lovers. And on this day, 1928, 84 years ago, the birth of Florida Governor Reuben O'Donovan Askew in Muskogee, Oklahoma. He turned down a running mate offer from George McGovern in 1972. Still living. One more before we say Dos Viranya. On this day, 1971, 41 years ago, the death of Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev of a heart attack. He succeeded Stalin, was ousted in 1964. Went to the Dhaka. We close with a thought from D.H. Lawrence, who spent time in Taos, New Mexico in the 1920s. He died in France in 1930, age 44. Quote, I want to live my life so that my nights are not full of regrets. This is Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon. This